there a speaker down here, did you say, or that?
No, this one's bigger. Yeah, I think you're good. Okay, well, welcome to everyone at Alice Glosser's Forum. I'm Rob Olson, one of the board members here at the Forum. And kicking off a new year, 2012, we're glad to see everybody here. Any first-time visitors that are here? First-time visitors? Okay, can you just, Sam, percent, give us your name?
Jeff Elmer.
Jeff Elmer, okay.
Scott Brown.
Scott Brown, welcome, Scott.
Adam,
nice to meet you. Nice to see you.
Doug Zork.
Doug Zork, okay, great. How'd y'all hear about it? Okay, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Juliet
Greenwald. Juliet, nice to have you here. Welcome, yes?
Philip Campbell.
Philip Campbell, okay, welcome. So how'd y'all hear about us?
Suzanne.
Great, well, welcome. We're glad you're here. As most of you know, we meet the second and fourth Tuesdays of the month, and we'll go from September through May. And we have typically a philosophy professor, instructor from one of the local universities or colleges that speak.
Mention the email list, too.
What's that?
The email list.
Oh, yeah, I'll mention that in a second. So if you haven't already paid, Jack Youngkin, our treasurer. Jack, you want to raise your hand? If you haven't paid, it's $5. If you haven't paid now, please do so after the lecture. We're a not-for-profit organization, and those funds will help us out. Students with an ID can attend for $2. If you want to become a subscriber, the cost is $35 for 6 months. And that leads me to the next point. Please put your cell phones on vibrate or turn them off, please, for courtesy for everyone here. Also, I encourage you to make sure that you pay for your meals. Every once in a while, someone will inadvertently forget to pay, and then Dallas Foster School will have to pick up the tab. And so, please make sure you pay your waitstaff and tip generously, please. We have our email. Our website is www.philosophersforum.org, and so information about the forum and about our website. About our organization, and you can sign up for our email list in on that website. So if you like what you hear tonight, then please go onto our website and sign up for our email, for the email list. We're also looking for volunteers. Anybody like sound? We're looking for volunteers to help Ken Sauter with our sound system to get some free meals and get to participate in the Foster's Forum. So if you're interested in helping us out with the sound, we would really appreciate that. Okay, now I'd like to introduce our speaker. Dr. Justin Fisher is an assistant professor of philosophy at SMU. He's spoken here once or twice before, I believe. He earned his PhD in philosophy from the University of Arizona with a minor in cognitive science. His areas of specialization include philosophy of the mind and cognitive science, as well as metaphysics. In addition, he has received numerous awards, published numerous articles, on a variety of philosophical issues, and is a frequent lecturer in a wide variety of philosophical venues. And one of the greatest things about Justin is that he's a University of Nebraska graduate, right? 1998, that was when the national championship, right?
Probably.
So I'm a big fan. Yeah, they won several, but anyway. His talk today is Metasemantics, Arguments Against Skepticism. And now please join me in welcoming Dr. Justin Fisher.
Great, and is my mic working?
It should be working.
Okay, great.
Keep talking.
Okay. Thanks for having me here. The talk I'll be giving today is one that I'll be giving at a conference in a couple of months, and so you all are my guinea pigs, so I'll thank you in advance for the opportunity of trying this talk out. I'll tell you the plan of the talk, which is I'm going to talk about various skeptical arguments that I call moderate or substitutional skeptical arguments. So first I'll sort of lay out what these arguments are and tell you what they have in common with each other. Then I'll suggest that there's a common resolution, a response that you can give that actually shows that there's something wrong with all these different skeptical arguments. So to get this common resolution, I'll argue for a metasemantic principle that follows from contemporary work in philosophy of mind and philosophy of language, and describe four corollaries of this metasemantic principle, and those will help to show what's wrong with all these skeptical arguments. That's what I'll do, and then in the third section of the talk is go back through those arguments and show why there's something wrong with all of them. And then in the final section of the talk, what I'm going to do is consider the limitations of this approach. Is this a solution to every skeptical argument ever, or are there limitations to this? It'll turn out there are a fair number of limitations, but there are also a fair number of arguments that quite a few people have given that this approach does provide a good response to. So that's good enough to, I hope, make the paper be interesting. Okay, so we're going to start off with going through these arguments. And hopefully many of you will be familiar with at least some of the arguments that I talk about, but it's a little bit of cause for concern just as it's supposed to be a broad audience. So I'll try to make each of these arguments at least somewhat clear to you, but the really important thing to be getting out of these arguments is just this idea that there's going to be a common structure between these arguments. So if you can get that common structure in mind, even if some of the particular arguments don't make complete sense to you, that'll probably be all right for our purposes today. Okay, so here's the first example of an argument like this. So this is an argument from the philosopher of science, Bosman Frossen. And he is considering various examples where scientists talk about things that we can't observe. So electrons, that's one example. And, you know, there's a scientific story. If you flip the light switch, what happens is that electrons flow through the wires that they get from the battery or whatever source of electricity to the light bulb, and the electrons going through the filament in the light bulb make the light turn on. That's the sort of scientific story about why lights turn on, so we have this idea of there being various experiments we can do where we interact with electrons that help to confirm that this is the right story of what's going on with electrons. And so when we use the term electron, it ends up referring to those little invisible electrons flowing through the wire. So on all my diagrams here, I'm going to use these sort of green arrows to have to do with this sort of interaction, in this case through the experiments on electrons. And I'll use this sort of thought bubble-like dotted arrow to indicate this sort of semantic relation, that the word electron means those little particles flowing through the wire. Okay, so that's the sort of picture that lots of us have in mind if we accept the sort of scientific story as to why lights turn on. But Van Frossen said, well, we can't be sure this story's right. He says, well, imagine maybe what's happening is there are little invisible demons that run around through the wires, and the demons get inside the light bulb and make it turn on, and the demons, for some reason, won't go past light switches that are flipped the wrong way. You know, that could be what's going on when the lights turn on. Maybe it doesn't involve electrons at all. That's Van Frossen's argument. He says, well, you can't see it. You can't tell that it's little particles rather than little demons. So if you can't tell the difference, then Van Frossen thinks, well, you can't be sure, at least, that it really is an electron there in the wire, or a bunch of electrons when you flip the switch. So he thinks we shouldn't believe in electrons. We should remain agnostic as to whether it's electrons or demons or something else that makes the lights turn on. And similarly, he thinks the same thing for other unobservable scientific causes. So he thinks we shouldn't believe that it's little invisible germs that make you sick. We shouldn't believe that the compass points north because there's an invisible magnetic field that's attracting the magnetic parts of the compass to spin around. So this gets him to a sort of skeptical conclusion. The key part of the structure of this argument is this idea that he says, well, here's the story you thought was the case. Here's some other story that we can substitute in, where we're basically substituting in demons for the electrons. And he ends up saying, well, that's what we've been interacting with, is these demons. But the word electron still means little particles, and so that's what's getting us to the skeptical conclusion that there aren't any electrons. So that's going to be the sort of crucial structure, this idea of substituting something else in to play the same role in interaction with us that the original thing we believed in was plain. That's going to be the common structure we'll see in all these arguments. So here's a second argument with the structure. As you're walking in, you probably saw the hallway with doors in it, and that's a door, and we've had lots of interactions with doors, it seems like. And so our word door means that sort of thing. So it seems like we should believe in doors. Not so, say, various epistemic skeptics who think that we lack knowledge. They'll say, well, for all you know, maybe we're living in the Matrix, and there aren't any doors. All there are these computer simulations, as though of doors, and then, you know, somehow there are wires plugged into our head feeding us those sort of sensory impressions as though of doors, but there aren't any real doors. And if that's the case, then saying that's a door would be false. And since we don't know whether we're in a matrix or in the real world, we don't know whether there are doors, so we don't have very much knowledge at all. So this is a much more sweeping conclusion than Van Frossen was saying, we don't know if there are electrons. This says you don't even know you're in a room. You might just be in the matrix. Okay, so there's another argument. Just going back to this again, you saw this sort of substitution that we had. The sort of real world, and here we're substituting in a computer simulation to interact with us in place of the real world. So that's, again, this idea of substitution and these substitutional skeptical arguments. Okay, here's another example. This is Illuminativism about philosophy of mind. Oh, by the way, I made up a handout. Hopefully many of you have gotten it, and I think there should be enough, just barely. But I listed all these arguments on there, so if you want to go back to them, you don't have to scribble them all down. They're written down there. And as you're reading it right now, I guess a sort of spoiler alert, the third column in the handout tells you what my eventual response to these arguments is going to be, so if you want to maintain the suspense, don't read the third column yet. Okay, so this argument is Illuminativism and philosophy of mind, and so you can take lots of examples of pointing at various people and thinking they have beliefs, and so you know, Homer might be disappointed because, you know, he's in the living room and the beer is in the fridge. I should have brought it with me, stuff like that. And so there's an attribution of a belief to somebody, and that lots of people have thought, well, whatever beliefs are, they need to be sort of sentence-like representations that are simple, they're discrete, they're separate from other beliefs, other things you believe. And so that's what it would take to have a belief, but once we, when we're interacting with those things, and that's what the word belief means, but once we actually do the brain scan, study how the brain works, it turns out, well, we don't have any sort of simple, discrete, sentence-like representations in the brain. Instead, the brain is a distributed neural network. Insofar as we have representations in it at all, they're spread out over a whole network of neurons, and they're sort of superposed on top of other representations in the brain. So it turns out we don't have any of those simple, sentence-like representations in our heads that we would have needed to have in order to have beliefs, at least according to this view of beliefs. So various people who are Illuminativists about mental states say, well, that means we don't have any beliefs, we don't have any desires, because we don't have any of these sort of simple representations, which is what they thought you would need to have. So again, we have what we're interacting with are these complex superposed distributed representations in our brains, whereas the word belief means this sort of simple symbolic representation instead. So we have no beliefs. This sort of argument is being given by Paul and Patricia Churchland and by Ramsey Stitch and Gehr. Okay, so again, we have the same structure of argument here. It's just applied to a different case. Here's another argument that probably would be familiar to lots of people, is the case of free will and determinism. Lots of people have thought, well, free will would need to involve some sort of capacity to choose otherwise. So it's sort of like, as you're making a decision, you could go down the left fork of the road, or you could go down the right fork of the road, and it's up to your free will to make the difference. You know, your brain, as it is right now, it really has both of these options available to it. A lot of people have thought that's what you'd have in order to have free will. A lot of people think, well, that's what we're interacting with when we talk about free will. But as we do physics of our world, it seems like, no, our brains are just physical objects. They're just changing in accord with the laws of physics as time goes by. What's true is that if you had one set of desires and you know, other states of your brain, that would lead you to take the one fork in the road. If you had a different set of desires, so you might not be able to read here, this says D2 rather than D1, but if your brain was in a different state, then you'd make a different choice, but it's not like there's any brain state you have where you really could choose either of two things from that brain state. Instead, you know, the state of your brain together with whatever boundary conditions matter, that's going to fully determine what choice you're going to end up making. Fair amount of evidence that this is how our brains actually work, and so skeptics about free will have said, well, if so, then we should take the hard determinist conclusion, the conclusion that, well, our actions aren't free after all. Okay, so there's another argument that has the same sort of structure, where we're substituting in something other than what we initially thought free will would need to be, like substituting that into the role where we're interacting with this sort of determinist way of making choices. That's what we're actually interacting with and calling free will, but it's not really free will because, at least according to this view, free will would need to have these spookier breaking the laws of physics, capable to do multiple things from a single brain state characteristics that, in fact, there is no such thing. Okay. Here's another argument. This one's a skeptical argument regarding colors. Very similar to the free will argument, this argument that ends up saying that, well, what does it take for something to be a color? A color would need to be a sort of simple property that's sort of present all over the surface of an object. As you view the color, you need to be able to tell exactly what colors are like as you're viewing it, and colors would need to be sort of independent of surrounding circumstances. That's what lots of people think it would take for an object to be colored. But as you start studying color, well, it turns out that, you know, if you zoom in on an object, it doesn't even have a uniform surface to start with. If you zoom in on objects, you'll see there's a bunch of atoms, and it's mostly void in between the atoms, rather than there being a smooth uniform surface that's all colored yellow. And, you know, it's just the sort of electrons being knocked up to higher orbits by photons that hit the surface, and then as they drop down, they re-emit photons of characteristic wavelengths, and that's what gets your eye to perceive an impression of color. But it's not like the object actually is colored, or at least that's the way the argument goes. Another sort of interesting feature, I really like this example, this is from a color scientist, Bill Lotto, where if you look at these two little patches here, right now they look like they're the very same color, but now I'm going to remove the white mask away. I didn't change the color of those two little patches, but now they're very strikingly different in color. They're still, the RGB values on the computer are just the same now. Here it is. So you get this sort of striking difference, and so it's showing, well, colors are really dependent on the surrounding context, or at least the way that we seem to see colors on objects, and it seems like, well, that's contrary to this idea that whatever color the object has just needs to be something inherent right there in the surface of the object. And so again, a lot of color scientists have thought, well, it turns out that there isn't anything in objects that would answer to the description we need to answer to in order to count as a color, so nothing has color. That's the conclusion of this skeptical argument. Okay. I keep hitting you with all these arguments, but hopefully you're seeing the common structure between them, and we only have a few more to go, three more, I think. So this one has to do with morality. A lot of people have thought that morality, if there were moral properties like goodness, that it would need to be queer. This is the sort of old British use of the word queer rather than the sort of contemporary American use, which has to do with homosexuality. This is queer just in the sense of odd. So what's odd about morality? Well, people have thought, well, if there is moral goodness would need to be the sort of property that would be motivational, that knowing what was good would motivate everybody to do what was good. People have thought that moral properties need to be sort of objectively binding, that it applies to everybody equally. If you're supposed to do some particular thing, then that binds everybody equally. And these sorts of queer properties, well, it seems like as we study our world, we can find lots of properties that, you know, are like mass and charge and stuff like that, but those don't seem to be inherently motivational. Some people are into mass. I'm sitting with a gentleman here who's into a Paleolithic diet, which is sort of opposed to mass, at least body mass anyway. And so you can have different attitudes towards mass, but it's not like anything in the world is just inherently motivational, inherently motivates you to want to do it. It seems like morality, if there really were such a thing as moral goodness, it would need to motivate us in this sort of way. But it turns out that there aren't properties like this. So I was doing a Google search trying to figure out what's the opposite of queerness, and so Rick Santorum showed up, which, yeah, it's not the only thing I found out about in the Google search that some of you know, and those of you who don't, you should remain ignorant. I don't even know Google Rick Santorum. But anyway, when you look at our world, it seems like what we have is stuff that isn't very motivational, I guess. At least this building, Iowa, he did motivate some people in the end to come out to vote for us, but he's a bit lacking in motivational quality, a bit boring, stuff like that. So here's an example of what's actually in our world. We don't have the sort of queer properties we need to have in order for morality to be realized, and so J.L. Mackey concluded there is no morality. Similar sort of argument is sometimes given and say, well, if there were moral properties, they need to be God-given, that God decreed that thou shalt not kill, and that's why it's morally wrong to kill. But if you think that God doesn't exist, then that would be another way of making the sort of argument of saying there's this sort of queer property being divinely decreed that nothing in the world actually displays, and so nothing is morally right or wrong as a consequence of that. Okay, so there's that argument. Here's another argument also involving morality. This one relies less on the sort of thought that moral properties would need to be queer. So this argument, I guess one way of thinking about it would be thinking, well, there are lots of different sorts of moral theories you could have, theories as to what's right and what's wrong. So if we think about the haystack, where the various straws in the haystack are different moral theories that you could have, but whatever the correct moral theory is, whatever really is right or really is wrong, that's just a needle in this haystack of false moral theories. And so the challenge would be to somehow pick out the correct moral theory and have that be the one that we make our moral judgments in accord with. And it would probably be easier if, you know, somehow God shone a light from heaven and picked out which moral theory was the correct moral theory. But if we don't have the benefit of that sort of thing, this sort of argument that Sharon Street and Richard Joyce have both given is to say, well, we don't have this sort of God-given light helping us to track actual morality, and worse than that, we're produced by this sort of evolutionary process that has selected us for things like living to an old enough age to reproduce and producing lots of children and stuff like that. What are the chances that evolutionary process is going to lead us to the needle rather than one of the many straws in the haystack? So their conclusion is, well, chances are we ended up with a false moral theory rather than a correct moral theory. The correct moral theory, the term good still refers to the needle, but chances are all the sort of random factors of evolution have led us to be interacting with one of the many straws rather than the needle. So our moral beliefs are probably false. Okay. So that's this argument for moral skepticism. And the very last argument that I'm going to give you is very similar structure. Eldon Plantinga points out, well, there's nothing in this argument really that relies on the nature of goodness. You know, we could make the same sort of argument for any property whatsoever, that we try to recognize that, well, evolution is going to shape us in ways that help us survive and reproduce, but having true beliefs doesn't always help you to survive and reproduce. You know, maybe it's actually better for me to think that I'm tall and handsome because I'll have a better chance of attracting mates if I'm more self-confident. And so Plantinga thinks, oh, evolution leads us to have beliefs that will do a good job at mating, but not necessarily beliefs that are true. And so Plantinga thinks, well, if evolutionary naturalism, sort of combination of evolution and thinking that's unguided, that there's no benevolent God watching out for us, that combination, if it's true, would suggest that we can't really trust our beliefs. They're as likely to be false as they are to be true. And that then has the interesting consequence that our belief in evolutionary naturalism will be undercut along with our other beliefs. So he thinks that evolutionary naturalism is self-defeating. So that's he thinks that if you believe in God, you can get out of this argument. But at any rate, it's giving a skeptical consequence for the evolutionary naturalist. Okay, so there's the menagerie of arguments. Those are the targets that I'm going to be arguing against today. And the sort of common structure of all these arguments, hopefully that's sort of jumped out to you by having the same animation on all the slides, but here I'll sort of talk explicitly about that structure, so I'm going back to the matrix argument again, is we have this sort of substitution where we take the matrix scenario and say, well, that's what we're actually interacting with. Well, our term, whatever term in this case I use, door, still refers to something other than the thing that we've actually been interacting with. That's the key sort of ingredient, where we took what would normally be, where we were saying what the referent for the term is something other than the thing we've been interacting with in the way that we normally would interact with reference of our terms. And so that's what I'll call these substitutional skeptical arguments, is because of having this sort of substitution being essential to the structure. Sometimes I'll call these moderate skeptical arguments. Also, towards the end of the talk, I'll distinguish these from more mild and more extreme skeptical arguments. So the sort of response I'm going to be giving to these arguments is to say, well, it's a mistake to think that our terms can sort of stubbornly continue to refer to these other things even while we spend our lives living in the matrix. So the argument I'm going to be giving is to say, no, we should really think about if, in fact, we're living in the matrix, if we've been living our entire lives in the matrix, then that thing's still a door. It's just that doors are these sort of computer data structures instead of being sort of fundamentally irreducible physical things. And so our word door refers to the sort of thing that we've been interacting with and using the word door for. So there actually are doors, they're just computational in nature. So there's something a little bit surprising about doors, but they still exist. That's the sort of view I'm going to be arguing for. Okay, so just regard whatever this picture that we used to associate with the word door was, and admit that if we are living in the matrix, then the word door actually does refer to doors, and so claiming that that's a door actually would be a true claim. So that's the sort of structure of response I need to give. So the first thing I'll need to do is explain, well, why do I think that the semantics for words like doors actually would end up leading to the thing we've actually been interacting with. So that's what I'll do in the second section of the talk. So I'll talk about these sorts of reasons coming from work in philosophy of mind and philosophy of language for thinking that the semantics for our terms actually does make reference and meaning go with our patterns of causal interaction rather than go with the sort of intuitive conception that we have of what a door would need to be. Okay. So we'll start with an example here. Let's take the example of water. And so we can imagine, you know, what, at least intuitively, water would need to be like if it could get some water here. So if you look at the water here and you think about, well, if you zoom in on this, at least intuitively, you'd think, well, if you keep zooming in, you'll keep seeing more water. Between any two points of water, there's just going to be more water in between the waters. That's what water seems like, and it seems like it's homogeneous also, that it's all going to be water. It's not like there are different sorts of things inside there. That's sort of, you know, like we were earlier considering arguments based on an intuitive conception of what free will would need to be like. An intuitive conception of water would require that it be continuous and homogeneous. That's the words that we get there. But of course, we all know that if you you'll run an electrical current through water, you'll get electrolysis happening. You can separate water apart from into the hydrogen and oxygen. And if you zoom in far enough, water is really a bunch of little atoms joined together in molecules. H2O is what water actually is. So I guess you could imagine drawing the skeptical conclusion from this. Scientists discover there is no water. know, that's not the right conclusion to draw. Right? Instead, what we should conclude what we should conclude is, oh, well, now we know something about water we didn't know before, that it isn't actually homogeneous in small scales, and it isn't actually entirely continuous, that there is a whole lot of little bits of void in between all the particles that make up water. So in the case of water, it seems like, despite the fact that intuitively we thought something would need to be like this in order to be water, instead, you say, well, that's not really relevant. Now that we understand that what we've actually been interacting with, what we've actually been drinking, what we've actually been watering our lawns with and washing our clothes with, was H2O, well, now we've learned that water is H2O. The word water means this H2O stuff. So what about these sort of earlier intuitive conceptions about what we thought water would need to be like? Turns out those were mistaken. Okay, so there's an example that's illustrating how the semantics, at least for the term water, it seems like they go with these patterns of regular usage rather than going with the sort of intuitive conception about what water would need to be like. Here's some other examples that have the same sort of structure. So first off, take solidity. A sort of intuitive conception of solidity would be that solid objects have no gaps, that it's sort of impermeable. However small of a thing you want to put to go through this small this solid table, you know, it's going to be impermeable to whatever objects you want. But, you know, it turns out people use different ways of using this metaphor, but that if you think about each atom that makes up something, the nucleus of that atom, if it were about the size of a pea, then the size of the atom, the electrons orbiting around it, which basically will repel electrons from other atoms, those would make it be the size of a football stadium, with the rest of it all being void in between. So if you zoom in on any object, you'll find that it's, you know, has about these proportions with this much void and only this much matter inside of them. So solidity, you know, this solid table, it's solid, but solidity is much different than we initially thought it was. And the word solid means this sort of structure that we've actually been interacting with. It doesn't mean this sort of intuitive conception that we used to have of what solidity was. Take the word atom. John Dalton introduced this to say atoms are indivisible building blocks of matter. Atoms are atomic. In fact, the Greek word atom is a means not, and tom means cuttable. So atoms are things that you can't cut. Oops, sorry, I'll cross that out. But then people discovered, well, actually, there are subatomic particles inside of atoms. Atoms aren't atomic after all. But so what? We've latched on to these things that are atoms, and that's what the word atom means. So what if we had this earlier intuitive conception of what atoms would need to be like? That was mistaken. The word atom still refers to atoms, even though they aren't atomic after all. Electron, G. Johnston Stoney introduced the word electron to be the smallest unit of negative charge, and then people did experiments to figure out what that was by suspending atoms or oil drops, figuring out how much charge it took to suspend an oil drop against gravity, and they estimated correctly what the charge of an electron was, what we now call an electron, but it turns out that there are even smaller things, quarks, like down quarks have a third of the charge of an electron, but that doesn't mean that the word electron actually refers to these quarks. No, electron refers to electrons. We're just mistaken to think that they were the smallest unit of negative charge. So, so again, we're getting a sort of idea that, well, once we started interacting with actual electrons and using the word electron for those, the word electron referred to those, even though we had a mistaken sort of description in mind as to what the nature of electrons was. We thought they were the smallest unit of negative charge, but they weren't. Okay, so so that's just a number of examples to suggest that the way that the semantics for various terms and concepts work is that it goes with these patterns of regular usage. And so using examples like that, that's one way of motivating this idea that semantics goes hand in hand with these patterns of regular usage. Here's another way of making this sort of argument is by considering what views in philosophy, mind and philosophy of language say. And it turns out that a lot of different views that disagree on lots of other things actually end up agreeing about this in different ways. So one sort of view often comes under the heading of causal theories of reference or informational semantic theories, hold that basically it's this causal error, the fact that H2O has been causing us to use the term water, to say that's water, or to associate various pieces of information with our concept of water. It's that sort of causal error, that's really what's making our term water mean H2O, is H2O has been causing us to use this term in appropriate ways. Another class of theories, which sometimes are called teleosemantic theories or pragmatic theories or success-linked theories, say, oh, really, it's this other causal error. It's the fact that when we use our concept of water, that makes us go drink H2O, which plays a useful role in our lives, to have H2O quenching our thirst, helping our metabolism and stuff like that. And so it's the fact that H2O is playing this useful role for us when we use the concept of water. That's what makes the concept of water mean H2O. So both of these theories are saying, yes, these patterns of causal interaction, that's what's making the term water mean H2O. And both these theories come under the heading of externalist theories, where they're saying, well, it's these patterns of interaction that are external to our brains. That's what's playing a role in making our words and concepts mean what they mean. You might wonder, well, what about internalist theories? Theories that say the meanings of our words and concepts just depend on what's going inside your brain. So traditionally, the sort of internalist theory that people had advanced was descriptivism, where descriptivists thought, well, whatever the sort of internal description you have in mind for water is, that determines what things actually count as water. That determines what things the word water refers to. And so if your description says that water needs to be continuous and completely homogeneous, then that's what something would have to be like in order for the term water to refer to it. But lots of people have abandoned descriptivism. There are classic arguments from Hilary Putnam and Saul Kripke and Tyler Burge that have convinced people that, well, sometimes the descriptions we have in mind don't actually fit the things that we're referring to. Sometimes we have descriptions in mind that actually fit something else better than the thing we're actually referring to. I guess the case of water is an example where this description doesn't actually fit H2O, and yet there's a pretty compelling case to be made to say, well, the term water still refers to H2O anyway. So that's an example of the sort of counterexamples to descriptivism that people have had in mind. So people who've been inclined to hold something like descriptivism have instead moved in the direction of the sort of causal descriptivism. So these folks say, well, it is inner descriptions that determine what our terms mean, but these descriptions are ones that contain some sorts of causal elements. So, for example, the descriptor might be, well, water is the stuff that I actually am causally interacting with. It's the stuff that I actually am drinking. And if you have those sorts of elements in your description, and those are strong enough to trump whatever these other elements you have in your descriptions are, then the causal descriptivist will end up saying, well, yeah, water does refer to H2O, so they get the intuitively right answer in this case. But the way they did it was by saying that, well, we needed to have basically these causal arrows included in this description that we use to determine the reference of our term. So it's this causal element in causal descriptivism basically is making the causal descriptivists end up agreeing with these other views that patterns of causal interaction are what end up determining reference for us. So even the causal descriptivist ends up agreeing with these other theories. So that's another way of making the argument that we should think that meaning, the spotted arrow, goes hand in hand with these green causal interaction arrows in the diagram, is that all these different theories, which, you know, this is the vast majority, at least, of current theories in philosophy of mind and philosophy of language, fall under one or other of these headings. Not quite everybody. I'll mention towards the end of the talk the possibility of saying, well, maybe what we need is a different semantic theory rather than one of these. But this seems to be, you know, a pretty widespread point of agreement, and if an argument needs to deny that any of these theories is right, then that's going to give that argument a sort of uphill climb. And so that's going to be at least enough to have shifted the burden against these skeptical arguments that I introduced before, so that they end up running afoul of what all these theories agree on. Okay. So here's a way of just sort of putting this point of agreement here. I call it a meta-semantic principle. It's this principle that all these certain semantic theories agree on. It says basically, if our usage of a term or concept involves a track record of appropriate causal interaction, that's these green arrows here, then our concept or our term is going to refer to what we've been interacting with that. So basically, if you have the green arrows, then you get the white dotted line also. Okay, so there's the meta-semantic principle. I've argued that this fits with our intuitions about these various cases that I talked about, and that it's a stunning point of agreement from these diverse views in philosophy of mind and philosophy of language. Now what I'm going to do is talk about four corollaries. The British say corollaries of this principle. So here's the first corollary. So long as there is a track record of appropriate causal interaction, actually all these corollaries are going to have this sort of preface of saying, well, if there is this track record of interaction, if there are the green arrows there, the first corollary is just going to say, well, as long as we have these green arrows there, then many instances where we say, oh, that's water, we point at something and say that's water, well, we'll be saying something true in those circumstances. Well, not always. There might be, find a bottle of gin somewhere. That's my excuse anyways. I thought it was water. So occasionally we end up pointing at something that isn't water and calling it water. But by and large, we're pointing at petrol H2O more often. And in fact, if we were usually pointing at gin and calling it water, then our term water would start to mean gin. It wouldn't mean H2O anymore. By and large, at least a lot of our applications of this term or this concept will need to turn out to be true, otherwise the meaning of the concept would change to mean whatever we were using it for instead. Okay, so that's getting us to the first corollary. Second corollary. The last one we were saying, well, if you use one concept and are just applying it to an object, that will often turn out to be correct. This one says, well, you get the same results when you use two concepts. So take water and liquid. We already saw that lots of instances of saying that's water only can turn out to be correct, but lots of instances of saying that's liquid will also have the same sort of argument. The things that we're calling liquids, we need to be correct a lot of the time in calling those liquids by corollary one. That's right, I should have practiced saying that word first. So a lot of those will be true, and from that it follows at least some instances, at least if we use a sort of induction of saying, we saw something that was both water and a liquid, so some water is liquid, when we draw conclusions like that, we'll often get true conclusions also, and maybe going out on a limb a little bit more, saying something like water is often liquid, that'll at least often also get us to true conclusions. So we're getting some more true beliefs involving multiple concepts at the same time, linking water and liquid together. Okay, third corollary. This one says that depending on which semantic theory turns out to be correct, there'll be certain other beliefs involving concepts that'll be likely to be true. So, for example, if the causal informational theory is true, then some of the diagnostic information we use to decide what things we're going to allow to cause us to use particular concepts, a lot of that diagnostic information will need to be true. If the heliopragmatic theory is true, a lot of the information regarding the usefulness, how it'll turn out to be beneficial to apply this concept to various things, a lot of that will need to be true. And if some sort of causal descriptivism is true, then these sort of descriptions, like I actually drink water, those will need to turn out to be true. And so you get other true beliefs out of whichever semantic theory turns out to be correct. Okay, so putting those together, all of them have this sort of preface, given that we have a track record of appropriate causal interaction for the relevant concepts. Corollary 1 said, well, many ordinary applications of each concept will be true. Corollary 2 says, well, you can use multiple concepts linked together, saying that some water is liquid, and you'll get true beliefs that way. Corollary 3 says you'll get some more true beliefs out of whichever particular semantic theory turns out to be correct. So putting these together, many beliefs involving concepts that have this track record of appropriate causal interaction will need to be true, and hence it will not be the case that these concepts are systematically used in error. So you can see here that why this is going to be a problem for all these skeptical arguments that we considered before, because these skeptical arguments substituted in something that did have the track record of appropriate causal interaction, and yet they wanted to say that we were using these concepts systematically in error. That nothing was color, nothing was right. We have no beliefs, no desires, something like that. All these things about us being systematically in error, if the meta-semantic principle is right, those are going to be in tension with thinking that we have an appropriate track record of causal interaction with something that could be a reference for these terms. The meta-semantic principle says, no, well, if you have that sort of track record of interaction, your term's going to start referring to the thing that you're interacting with, so we won't be systematically in error after all. So that's the sort of response they're going to give. So here I'll talk through how that response would go. So we get, again, this sort of rundown of all the arguments, and now that the third column in the handout won't be spoiling it that view on that. So going back to Van Frossen's argument that we shouldn't believe in electrons and germs and magnetic fields, well, if there is something that we're regularly interacting with, these little demons, then when we use electron talk, we're tracking where these demons are and when they can make their way through wires and stuff like that. Well, that means that the word electron is going to refer to these demons. And it might be surprising that electrons are little creatures with minds of their own. We thought they were just particles, but that doesn't mean electrons don't exist. It just means they're a little different than what we originally thought they were. So the right conclusion to draw, at least using this sort of case, is that electron refers to the buzzing demons, or whatever it is that we end up being interacted with. So it turns out that a lot of our assessments of there being electrons in this wire are actually true after all. So cases like this, at least, don't give us reason to think that there aren't electrons. At worst, they give us reason to think that electrons might be a bit different than we initially thought they were, and so we should be maybe a little less confident in thinking that electrons are these simple, indivisible things, because maybe they'll turn out to have, you know, properties that we didn't know they had. Okay, so that takes at least a lot of the bite out of Van Frossen's scientific net arguments. How about the matrix sorts of arguments? This sort of response has actually been given by Hilary Putnam and David Chalmers. Two matrix arguments, and it says, well, if it turns out that we're actually living in a matrix, what we've actually been interacting with are these computer simulations of doors, well, our term door still refers, it just refers to a certain sort of kind of data structure inside the computer simulation. It doesn't mean there aren't any doors, it just means doors are these computational things rather than irreducible physical things. Chalmers has this really interesting paper, Matrix as Metaphysics, where he sort of says, well, the matrix hypothesis is sort of a combination of a hypothesis where you think maybe physical reality is fundamentally computational in nature, which is something that people have suggested for independent reasons. Combine that with a sort of dualist hypothesis that our minds are of a different sort of nature than the things in the world around us. Well, that's basically what the matrix hypothesis is that your mind is in the matrix and that all the things that you're interacting with, all the things you're seeing in the room, are of a fundamentally different sort, computational sort. Palmer says, well, that's just a metaphysical hypothesis as to what the nature of actual tables and chairs and doors might be. It's not some sort of skeptical reason to doubt that doors exist. It's just a funny story as to what doors might turn out to be like in the end. So again, this takes a lot of the bite out of the skeptical argument, though I guess it still does have this sort of a little bit sobering conclusion to say, well, maybe you shouldn't be completely confident that doors are irreducibly physical. It could turn out that our world's computational, and doors have this inner computational structure. To me, that's not all that much weirder than finding that doors have atomic structure and are mostly void in between the atoms and stuff like that. I mean, we already are willing to accept lots of weird conclusions about the nature of doors without doubting the existence of doors. you know, saying that it might turn out to be computational, that's not that much weirder, I don't think. Okay, so that's a reason to be confident that there are doors. How about eliminativism? Well, again, we've been regularly calling certain sorts of things that have been going on in our brains, beliefs, and desires. So what if it turns out that those aren't as discrete and sentence-like as people initially thought beliefs and desires would be? That doesn't mean we don't have beliefs and desires. It just means that beliefs and desires are more complicated, these sort of distributed superpositional representational structures inside the neural nets of our brains. Instead, it doesn't mean they don't exist. So that's a sort of response. And in philosophy of mind, I think this is the way that most people have gone. Eliminativists are a small minority in philosophy of mind. But you still are there, and so I can pick on it. Good. How about free will? There actually are quite a few more hard determinists still around, but I think the same sort of conclusion applies here. When we discover that we don't have this sort of capability of making things happen independently of what the laws of physics say, how the world's going to develop, well, that doesn't mean we don't have free will. It just means that whatever is going on in our ordinary decision-making, that's free will, and it may not have all the features that we thought free will would need to have. But we still make free choices, they just aren't as exotic as we initially thought that they would be. I think there actually have been newspaper headlines like this, but I couldn't find one of those, so I made one up. But if you see these sort of stories that say scientists say there is no free will, you know, I think you should really take those with a grain of salt, because you know, any finding that suggests we don't have free will is probably a finding that suggests that we mistakenly understood the nature of free will before, and now we've discovered more about what free will is actually like. Okay. A couple more arguments here. Color, again, these findings about the ways that objects actually reflect light, those aren't findings that show us that color doesn't exist. Instead, they're findings that show us that color is more complicated than we initially thought, and that colors, rather than being possessed directly by objects themselves, they're sort of relations between objects and the background that you're looking at. So you get these sorts of contrast effects, like the example I showed you before. It doesn't tell us that objects aren't colored, it just tells us that we need a more sophisticated understanding of the nature of color. Okay, in case of morality, we have the argument saying, well, more properties would need to be these queer properties, and there aren't those sorts of queer properties in the world, but we've still been interacting with some sorts of properties, and I actually, at least given my moral views, Rixlin Torn probably isn't a good example of something that I use the word good for very often. So I'll substitute in hopefully a less controversial case of child helping this old lady cross the street. That's got to be a good action, if anything is. And that's the sort of action we've been interacting with in using the term good. And so our conclusion shouldn't be, well, that sort of option wouldn't motivate a sociopath to do things, so there is no morality. No, that's not the conclusion we should draw. We should instead draw the conclusion, well, moral goodness isn't quite oomphy enough to motivate sociopaths to do the right thing. There still is moral goodness, it's just not quite as exotic again as queer as people initially thought it would be. Now, one reaction I get when I give this argument is saying that, I'm going to go one more slide because we have another moral skepticism one, and then I'll talk about this. So let's consider the other moral skepticism one, and then I'll consider some of the upshots. So this argument had said that finding the correct moral theory is like finding a needle in a haystack. What are the chances we have stumbled on the right one, given evolutionary justice? Actually, do we have this flashlight? I can probably do this as an example, because I think this is a nice way of showing the structure of this argument. Jack, I'll actually give you... Are you Jack or are you Bob? Bob, I'm sorry, but I got it right eventually. Good. I have the flashlight. What I want you to do is point that at somebody while I'm not looking, and what you're going to be doing is designating the correct moral theory. So imagine everybody in the room is a potential moral theory. You might say different things like, one of you says maximize overall happiness, that's the right thing to do. Other somebody else says do the virtuous action that follows the Boy Scout oath, and somebody else says, I don't know, do an action that you could will be the maxim for everybody. Okay, so Bob's going to pick somebody as the correct moral theory using the flashlight. Okay, you all see what the correct moral theory is? Now, stop shining the flashlight, shut it off. Got it all shut up? Okay, so now I'm looking. So now I'm going to go around and try to figure out what the correct moral theory is. What are the chances I'll get the correct moral theory? You know, I have no feedback. There's nothing that's guiding me to the correct moral theory. So in these arguments, I don't think it really matters that it's evolutionary processes. You know, it could be any process, whether it's sort of cultural evolution or whether it's careful reasoning on the basis of evidence, whatever process you use, if the meaning of the term good is determined independently from this sort of pattern of causal interaction of what I use the word good to talk about, you're going to have these skeptical worries that I'm going to end up using the term for something other than what it actually means. Now if I can get the flashlight back. Let's do a second version of this game. This time what I'm going to do is I'm going to shine the flashlight myself as I'm interacting with things. And I'll say, good. Now, if I keep using the term good for what I'm shining the flashlight on, so I'm shining it on Doug here, and that's what I'm interacting with, according to the metasemantic principle, it says that my term good is going to refer to what I'm interacting with as I'm using the term. So basically, I get to set the target myself. My usage term, our collective usage, sets the target. And so in this case, what are the chances I'll end up using the word correctly, that I'll correctly identify things as good? This case is pretty high because I'm setting the target through my own usage myself. And so the metasemantic principle is basically saying, well, that's how the semantics for our terms work, is we're setting the targets for ourselves. And so you don't get this possibility of this sort of mismatch. And I think that really shows what's wrong with these sorts of arguments, is they're just assuming that what our terms mean is independent of how we're using them. But there isn't that sort of independence. You know, how we're using them ends up determining what they mean, and so you end up having quite a lot of assurance that a lot of uses of our terms are going to be true. So good refers to whatever kind we've actually been regularly using it for. As long as there is such a kind, it doesn't matter what process it was, whether it was evolution or some other process that led us there. As long as we got that pattern of regular causal interaction, we'll end up referring and we'll end up forming lots of true beliefs. Okay. Now, some people will respond to this by saying, well, that sounds awfully relativist. Like, morality ends up being up to us, which what's good is whatever we ended up calling good often enough made it be good, or at least made it be what our term good means. And so this raises the issue, well, is that objectionable? And morality doesn't seem like it's something that, you know, the Nazis called it good to set up concentration camps and kill the Jews, but it doesn't make it good just because they called it good. So there's a worry that, well, maybe this ends up being a sort of moral relativism, which should be obviously wrong. Now, the initial answer to this concern is to say, well, this doesn't force us to be relativists any more than it would force us to be relativists about chemicals. You know, what makes the term water mean H2O is that we've been shining our usage on H2O. That's why the word water refers to H2O. And that doesn't force us to be relativists about water. You know, we could have used the water to mean, you know, gin or ice cream or whatever. There are lots of other things we could have used the word for, but that doesn't mean that chemistry isn't an objective science. And so this doesn't force morality to be a sort of subjective relativist sort of field. So it still opens the question, well, should we be moral relativists? And I'm not going to answer that question now, but I'll sort of indicate the sorts of things that would depend on. So one possibility is that morality will turn out sort of like etiquette. So this is a picture of the European style of holding your knife and fork. I think that's still happening. Where you... I guess this is the hidden style, where you hold each of them pointed down, you cut your food, and then in the European style, you lift it up to your mouth like this, using your left hand. Whereas the American style, Instead, you'll cut your food, and then you'll put down your knife, switch your fork to your right hand, and shovel it in like a spoon. I couldn't find a great picture of that. This is the best picture I found of the American eating. So there's two, I guess, perfectly good ways of having your etiquette be set up, and the Europeans have ended up saying polite means this, and Americans have ended up saying polite means that. There are two references there. It's like two straws in the haystack, and there's polite for Europeans and there's polite for Americans, and you know, it pretty much ends up being a sort of relativism, because there's that. It could be that moral systems are like that. There's multiple different systems. Each of them will work out sort of well. It's possible for one community to converge on one set of moral norms, another community just converge on another set of moral norms. So the first community's moral terms mean the first set, the second community's moral terms mean the second set, and that's all the more there is to it. It could turn out that morality's that way, but it also could turn out that morality's more like chemistry, or I think maybe a better example is thinking about convergent evolution in biology, where here we have a penguin and an ichthyosaur and a dolphin, where you can see these are structurally very similar because they evolved to swim through the ocean in very similar ways. They had very similar lifestyles, so they ended up converging on these structures, even though penguins used to be, you know, they had ancestors who flew, and dolphins had ancestors who ran on the ground. Oops, I couldn't find the dolphins. That helps to demonstrate one big thing. And so we have this sort of convergence that a whole lot of different species end up converging on the same sorts of designs, and it might be that morality is like that, that if you get a community of agents interacting with one another, maybe it's sort of like a Nash equilibrium in game theory, where they're going to converge on certain sets of norms to govern their interaction, and there is one sort of moral truth. Like, there was one chemical kind, H2O, that chemists on alien planets are also going to discover also, and that multiple communities of chemists will converge on that as their chemical theory. It might be that morality is like that also. Which way is it? You know, that's way outside the scope of this talk to figure out, but I just want to emphasize that taking this sort of approach that I'm taking leaves open this question. So I'm not forcing moral relativism. Moral relativism might be right, but if so, that's going to be because there are all these different moral systems that are equally good, and whether that's the case, I don't know. Good. Okay, so that's my quick disclaimer about that, or avoidance of a potential objection there. The last argument I mentioned was Plantinga's argument, and basically the same response to, you know, his argument was that this shining the flashlight argument would work on any term, not just morally good. I said, well, it doesn't work on the term morally good, and similarly it won't work on other terms also. That terms meanings shift to the things we regularly use them for. So there's no possibility for deep systematic errors in our beliefs. Planning his argument that, well, we've got to worry if we evolve that maybe we're wrong a lot of the time. It shouldn't be a real deep worry that we're wrong all the time. Okay, so that gives the sort of responses to all these different arguments. Now, in the last section of the talk, what I want to do is consider the limitations of this approach. So I mentioned that I call these moderate or substitutional skeptical arguments, and here's the sort of structure again where we have the meaning of a term being quite separate from the patterns of regular causal interaction involving the terms. So the term might mean irreducible physical door, whereas what we've been interacting with are doors in the matrix. And I've argued that these sorts of arguments assume that meaning can come apart from usage in a way that meaning doesn't come apart from usage. So these arguments don't work out. But there are two other sorts of skeptical arguments that might still work. So one is what I call mild skeptical arguments. But these ones allow that we have some sort of regular pattern of usage, and that determines reference. That meaning matches up to regular usage, but holds that in some particular case, we had a departure from this pattern of usage. So I gave you an example of this before, the example where we regularly use the term water to track H2O, but I accidentally point out something that isn't H2O. I point out some gin instead. That would be a mild departure. Whereas allowing that meaning and usage line up but holding that in a particular case we departed from that. And so that's compatible with the metasemantic principle. I haven't given any argument that cases like this can't happen. There are also extreme skeptical arguments. These would be ones that deny that we have the relevant sort of interaction with anything at all. And as far as the metasemantic principle is concerned, it said, well, if you're regularly interacting with something, then your terms are going to mean that thing. But all bets are off if you aren't regularly interacting with something. So what your terms are going to mean in those cases, different semantic theories will disagree about those cases. Those are hard to figure out. And so if you can argue that we haven't been using the term in regular causal interaction with anything at all, that would be a way of getting around my solution to these arguments. So let's say a little bit more about each of these other options. So mild ones, again, these are going to be ones where we say there is a regular pattern of usage for one thing, and yet in this case we ended up pointing at something else and using the concept mistakenly for it. So many ordinary errors are going to be cases of this, where, you know, we don't always use our concepts correctly. Sometimes we make mistakes, and usually it's going to be because we're pointing, you know, we're sort of departing from the regular background of using the term correctly. We depart from it. That's how we make mistakes in lots of cases. Some philosophical arguments would fit with this. So if you have sort of recently, you know, you lived most of your life in a flesh and blood body, but last night people kidnapped you, they put you in the mad scientist laboratory, they cut your brain out of your body, and they plugged you into the computer simulation, and so now you think you're in a room listening to a philosopher talk, but really now you're plugged into a computer, getting fed impulses from the computer. In this case, you have your regular background of interaction with a flesh and blood world, a physical world, and now what you're mentally pointing at is a computer simulation, something quite different from what you've been using the terms for before. So as long as it happened to you recently, so your terms still mean what you had been interacting with, but what you are now pointing at is something different, that's a potential for error. And so insofar as you take those possibilities seriously, then you might still get skeptical conclusions. Other cases that are sort of like this is dreaming. If we regularly use the term water for H2O as we're awake, but then when you dream and you dream of the ocean, well, you might say, oh, there's some water, and you're mistaken. You're just dreaming stuff, and there isn't. You aren't correctly applying your concept in the dream, or in the hallucination might be similar. So these, again, are going to be mild departures, but insofar as you might worry that you might just be dreaming that you're here rather than actually here, then that might raise some skeptical worries as to whether or not you can know that you're in a room listening to a talk. Hume's problem of induction, the worry that maybe the future won't continue the way that the past had. Sure, the sun rose every other day of my life, but that's no guarantee that the sun will rise tomorrow. That's another example where we have the past track record of interaction that can determine the meanings of our terms, but things might change in the future, and it's not clear that my argument gives you any reason to be confident that the future will continue the way that the past was. And so I'm not sure my argument gives any sort of resolution to Hume's problem. Okay, so there's sort of recognizing that there are some skeptical arguments that philosophers have given that that are immune to the sorts of arguments that are the sort of response that I give. Let's consider extreme skeptical arguments. So these are ones that deny that we have the relevant sort of interaction with anything at all. So one example here is many atheists, they don't give a substitutional argument. They don't say that, you know, sort of like the Wizard of Oz, it turns out there was this guy behind the curtain that we've actually been interacting with when we asked the wizard to do stuff for us. So atheists don't say, well, there's just some ordinary guy doing all the things that God did. Atheists instead typically say, no, there's nobody playing the God role. When we pray, nobody answers our prayers. We aren't interacting with anything. And so they're giving an extreme skeptical argument then. And so my sort of response of saying, well, if you think we've been interacting with something, then that's what our term God means. We can't give that response here because they don't think we have been interacting with something at all. If the theist is right, that we have been interacting with God, that he has been listening to our prayers and giving us stuff in return, then you get these patterns of causal interaction. So my view is compatible with both atheism and theism. other examples, Bertrand Russell had the example of our universe having been created 15 minutes ago, so we had no chance to form any sort of regular patterns of interaction with things. My argument doesn't give you a great way of responding to that. One more second. Okay. Purely random universe. Maybe our universe is completely random and any sort of semblance of order that we've had, it's just been a fluke in the sort of static that we've been receiving. My argument doesn't give us any response to that. And you might construe Descartes' evil demon argument that depending on whether or not how much regularity there is and what the demon does in manipulating us, you might think that our terms end up referring to aspects of the demon simulation he's setting up for us, or you might think the simulation's just random enough that there's no reference there, in which case this could be the sort of extreme skeptical argument that my response wouldn't be able to do anything. Okay, I'll skip that one. So here are the options I see. I'll just quickly mention them, and then you guys can ask me questions about them. So one option for moderate skeptics is to try to switch to mild skeptical scenarios that allow for long interaction determining reference and yet still raise reasons to worry that, well, maybe we've gone wrong in this particular case. I think those arguments tend to be less gripping and tend not to yield the sort of sweeping radical conclusions that skeptics have often wanted to get. So I'm not sure this will work for them, but it's one option. Another option would be to switch to extreme skeptical arguments. Deny that we've had the relevant sort of interaction with anything at all. But I guess one virtue of most of these modern substitutional skeptical arguments is they tried to give us a plausible story as to why the world seemed as regular as it did. Why did the lights turn on whenever we flipped the switch? Well, because there were the demons playing the electron role, so we have some explanation for the regularity. If you try to go extreme, you give up on there being an explanation for the regularities we observed, and that seems to make the scenarios less worthy of consideration if they leave lots of things unexplained. Another option for moderate skeptics would be to abandon the sort of three main classes of semantic theories that I talked about and try to find the semantic theory that keeps reference independent from prolonged patterns of causal interaction. And this is implausible partly because it runs against prevailing wisdom in philosophy of mind and philosophy of language, and it also risks blanket skepticism. If you have too much independence between meaning and usage, then this we get back to the flashlight scenario where Bob was shining the flashlight and our usage is completely independent of that. So what are the chances our usage ends up being correct? And so this ends up, you might get some skeptical conclusions out of this, but you might get too many skeptical conclusions out of it. Good. And if it can't fix these modern skeptical arguments in any of those ways, then I think we should treat these arguments with great skepticism. Okay. Thanks, everyone.
But we have a few minutes for some questions. Just let me preface this by saying, please try to avoid Shakespearean soliloquies and make your comments very quick and get to a question for our speaker, Bob.
Your analysis of some African analysis is excellent. What I am wondering, and been wondering all the way through it, is what are the implications for actual ontological observations of reality, forgetting what you call something, forgetting those types of skeptical arguments. You cannot, be skeptical of something that is presented to you directly.
I've heard these sorts of concerns, especially thinking about the big cross argument.
What
with
is the ontological relevance to it?
I've had these sorts of concerns, especially with respect to the Van Frossen argument, where I end up saying, well, yeah, even if there are demons running through the wires, we can still be confident that there are electrons. So there's a sense in which I've weaseled out of the skeptical worries by saying, oh, yeah, electrons exist. We don't have to worry about that. But it seems like there's still quite a bit of skepticism lurking here, where I say, well, yeah, I'm sure they exist, but what are they like? Are these fundamental particles that you can't divide apart? Or are they little demons, or are they some other structure? And I think this is close to what you're asking about, well, what's the ontology of electrons like? I say, well, we can be really confident that electrons exist, but as to what their fundamental nature is, I have to remain quite agnostic. We aren't in a position to know until we get the super colliders working better to figure out whether we can smash electrons apart and find out what their nature is like. At this point, we need to be quite agnostic regarding the nature of them. Similarly, doors. I'm very confident doors exist, but are they fundamentally computational or fundamentally physical? I don't know. So there's a fair amount of skepticism, or at least agnosticism, that's still present in my view. I'm confident that as long as we keep using our terms the way we've been using them, we'll say a lot of true things, but there's a whole lot of ignorance that we have also. We don't know a whole lot about the nature of the things that we're using the terms for. And, you know, a lot of this, you know, those of you who are familiar with Immanuel Kant talking about this sort of noumenal nature of things in and of themselves, I'm sort of granting that, yeah, we will have great difficulty knowing a whole lot about those, but we can still be confident that as we use our terms in the ways we've been regularly using them, we're using them correctly, even if we don't know a whole lot about the things we're using.
So it still depends on a particular doctor's shop. Mm-hmm. Isn't that true?
I think in some sense of saying that you know, our way of looking at the world is, I guess in some sense we're saying as long as we're using our terms consistently in interaction with the world, we'll manage to say true things despite, you know, there being a whole lot of stuff that we don't know about what the world is like.
Throughout your talk, I've been replaying my memories of reading a paper at Quine, which is known as the Quinerve paper. It's all about really use of language and the way it's used. That's been essentially what you're talking about here. I don't really see much except the application of skepticism on the intuitionism and all of which was spelled out. That kind of observation.
Yeah, I think of this argument as sort of saying that the old Twin Earth argument, which basically amounts to the argument I was giving, where I said water, we have these sort of intuitive conceptions of what water would need to be like, but instead we think water actually means H2O, because that's what we've actually been interacting with. I think people just haven't seen the implications of that sort of argument. And Putnam, who gave that argument originally, pointed out that, yeah, this gives you a response to matrix brain and back sort of arguments. But still, you know, a lot of the other arguments that I mentioned, like, say, the Street and Joyce arguments for moral skepticism, these are arguments published in the last 10 years, and, you know, whereas Putnam was writing this stuff back in the 70s. And so the results that people recognize in philosophy, in mind and philosophy of language, have implications for lots of arguments that people are still giving, but people haven't recognized those implications yet. And so the point of this paper is to say, hey, wait a sec, the things you all are presuming are in tension with these semantic theories, and so either we need a new semantic theory or there's something wrong with these arguments, and I think there's something wrong with these arguments.
Right.
Oh yeah, when I saw the photograph of the guy, the kid walking the little lady across the street, it reminded me of Martin Harris's explanation of how the Hindus adopted vegetarian when populations got to such a level that they needed to eliminate all people. And by becoming vegetarian, they cut off one third of the lifespan and justified all this by anthropomorphizing animals and making it the moral good to protect them from being eaten. And doesn't your little metasomatic principle allow for these kinds of not seen right things to go on?
I think of this as a sort of, I mentioned the moral relativism sort of worries that maybe one community will end up using the term good in one way where eating animals is all right, and another community will start using the term good in another way where eating animals isn't all right, and you think that there's something objectionable about doing things the second way, that shouldn't be morally all right to do it in the Nazi way, or perhaps
right,
in the way
old,
that leads to lots of old people
that's
dying. And you know, I think ultimately what this is going to hinge on is, you know, it may be that this is sort of like etiquette, that each of these is a system of norms that a community could adopt, and there's nothing more moral about one of them than about the other. But I'm not sure that that's how it will turn out. I think it may turn out that we're sort of using the term good to track some sort of systems of community organization that are sort of at equilibrium in the sort of interaction space or the space of the game that we're playing with one another, and that whatever the moral norms that account for how that equilibrium is reached would dictate an answer as to whether or not you have to meet or not. I'm not an ethicist, or a meta-ethicist. I'm not sure what you want to talk to about that question, but I think there's at least a possibility that it would turn out that we've all been using the term good in a way that's latched onto a kind that dictates an answer to this question. And so as to what the answer is, I'm not sure.
there's a good involved by killing off the old people. They were able to reach a billion in population, so I guess that's a evolutionarily killing old people with.
Yes, sir.
Some of these skeptical arguments seem to depend on ignorance about the details of the interaction with the thing that they're skeptical about. This could be hapless ignorance, ingrained ignorance, or even kind of wrong-headed ignorance. Like, I'm too lazy, or I couldn't be bothered to learn, to make the effort to learn the concepts, to go after the interactions, carefully considered interactions. That would demolish my skeptical argument. So as long as I preserve my ignorance, I can be skeptical.
I'm not sure that's right. I think, if we take, say, the arguments involving the limit of vision and philosophy of mind, these arguments are saying, well, the folk who have talked about beliefs and desires were committed to thinking that they were these simple sentence-like representations that you could just put in ordinary English sentences. And they were ignorant in using the terms in that way, but you would say the churchlings are making these eliminativist arguments. They are, as empirically informed as any philosophers of mind are. They're delving into the neuroscience and saying, well, here's how the brain actually works. And it's not at all the way that the folk thought it worked. And so folk terms like belief and desire, they just don't apply to the brain. They have this really simplistic picture that doesn't match the complexities of how the brain actually works. So I think they would say, well, yeah, there's some sort of ignorance at play here, but the ignorance was in a sort of folk theory of what beliefs and desires would be like. I, the skeptical arguer, I, Paul Churchin, have the sophisticated, well-informed theory of what's going on in the brain, and so it's because I'm well-informed that I can see that beliefs and desires still exist. So I'm not sure that his argument hinges on his being ignorant. It hinged on the thought that the meaning of the term belief could be determined by these sort of folk preconceptions of a bunch of people who are ignorant about how the brain actually works.
I was thinking more the scientific, like, for instance, seeing a difference between an essential charged particle from a certain amount of mass and a little, being with a will. I mean, if you could look at it very superficially, you could say there's no difference. But yet, you could do a lot of experiments and learn a lot of math and come to the conclusion that, whatever electrons are, they're not behaving like little, independent agents, willful agents.
Yeah. So the way that Van Frossen structured that argument is he was going to basically say, well, if the demons are willful agents, then they have this sort of single-minded intent to go this way through the wire and stuff like that. So he's intending the demon hypothesis to be one that'll end up being empirically equivalent, that there's no observations we can make that could tell the difference between it being little, simple, or single-minded demons running through the wire versus particles running through the wire, that as far as our experiments are concerned, they would end up being the same way. But he thinks that, well, we can't tell whether it actually is electrons or demons that single-mindedly do all the things that electrons would have done. And so he thinks we have to remain agnostic as to whether there actually are electrons. Of course, my response is to say, well, if it's single-minded demons, then electron refers to those, so we can be confident there are electrons. We just need to be agnostic as to what their fundamental nature is.
There's no observable difference between the two as long as you're on Earth.
Yeah, so...
With our political campaign heating up, presidential campaign, what type of skepticisms are you seeing in some of the candidates out there? How would you categorize those type of skepticisms?
That's interesting. I haven't thought about this, but the first example that came to mind was there are a lot of global warming deniers in at least one of the parties. I'm trying to decide whether this is an example.
Extreme skepticism, one party talking about the other party.
So I guess if they were going to end up being moderately skeptical arguments, let's just play with the global warming case and see if it would work. So the global warming denier says there is no global warming. Now if they were saying, well, here's this thing that we've actually been tracking and then calling global warming, and we've been regularly using the term global warming for that, but it just is some normal fluctuation in the environment. I think we're trying to get people to be quiet here so others can listen to the answer. If there is that sort of other potential referent that we've been using the term for, then they'd end up be giving a moderate skeptical argument. And I don't know, I think some of the global warming deniers say, well, you've been tracking real phenomena with your data, but it's just natural climate variation. It's the same sorts of things that lead to the gas that will lead to the next ice age or whatever. And it's not this sort of special man-made sort of thing. And I guess it could turn out that the term global warming refers to something quite natural like that, and we were mistaken in thinking that it involved man-made processes that are going to skyrocket into accelerating temperature rises. So that would end up being a way of my response to them would say, okay, well, maybe global warming exists and is this weird sort of thing. But then we still have the question about, well, what are the future implications of it going to be? So I'm not sure this ends up changing policy.
We have time for a couple more questions. David?
Now I understand why Dr. Beast is softness.
These sorts of examples of mild and extreme skeptical argument, I don't see a good way of arguing that I wasn't kidnapped last night and put in the vat. And I don't see a good way of arguing that the sun will definitely rise tomorrow. I still think that I wasn't embedded last night, and I still think the sun will rise tomorrow. But the sort of argument I was giving here, I don't see a way of using it to establish those conclusions. And so maybe I'm slippery and can argue for quite a few conclusions, but I don't think I'm slippery enough to argue for just anything.
Okay, Ed, last question.
The principle of language use that you have been elaborating is that words mean what we recognize in their surroundings. That makes them happen. The meaning is not somehow magically in the word. We have to recognize something that makes that word appropriate. And this is something that has come up in my Sunday school classes discussions. We are revisiting Thomas Kuhn. And Kuhn is famous for doubting that science actually produced and
an improved picture of the world. And my argument is that it does, if you understand correctly. Now, Kuhn's basis for this was, how can we say that science is getting progressively better when the ontologies and the theories are incommensurate, and we, obviously, the substances of Aristotle and the mixtures of atoms of Dalton are just not the same thing. But in many, many instances, we see examples where words have been used approximately, and then the approximation improved. And for example, there's the Boy Scouts have heard that there was an insane felon loose terrorizing one of them. Might say, "Well, I saw it move in the bush, having seen a shadow." And when he goes in there further, it's a man dressed up in a gorilla suit. And the scoutmaster goes out, and no, it's actually a man dressed up in a bear suit. And all of those things are correct descriptions of reality. But we like to deny the old-fashioned descriptions of reality. But it's plain to see, just stand out in the field, you see that the sun goes around the earth from east to west. That's still an accurate description of reality in a particular locus.
You're right that there's a tension between the sort of semantic view that I advocated here and Kuhn's idea of increments or billings. So one example that he talks about is the way that Newton thought about mass versus the way that Einstein thought about mass, where for Einstein, mass is interconvertible with energy equals mc squared, that's energy and mass together, whereas for Newton there wasn't any sort of convertibility like that. And so Kuhn will say, well, when Newton said mass and when Einstein says mass, they mean completely different things. Whereas on my view, we'd say, well, we've been talking about mass, we've been interacting with mass. Even Newton was recognizing which objects were more massive than other objects were. Newton just had a mistaken understanding of mass. He didn't recognize the actual relation between mass and energy. And so Einstein has gotten a better understanding of mass than Newton had, whereas Kuhn thought that they were just talking past one another using terms that sounded the same but meant completely different things. And so I guess I'm with you and against Kuhn in this case.
Let's give another round of applause. And